This podcast is brought to you by ClearBridge Investments. Meet an evolving economy confidently with ClearBridge Active Equities, the foundation of a resilient portfolio. ClearBridge, a Franklin Templeton company. Go to clearbridge.com to learn more.
Please stay tuned for important disclosure information at the conclusion of this episode.
Welcome to Investing Insights. I'm your host, Ivana Hampton. Some investors argue putting a lot of money in your highest conviction stock picks is the way to beat the market. Others claim making an outsized bet on one or more stocks is too risky and similar to gambling. What does the data say? Do big stock bets tend to hurt or help equity portfolios? Morningstar Research Services Senior Manager Research Analyst Jack Shannon ran the numbers. He's here to share what he learned. Thanks for joining me, Jack.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So, Jack, you research what kind of value so-called big bets bring to mutual funds. Let's start off with how you define a big bet.
Yeah, so for this study, we wanted to find instances going back 25 years of managers who made sizable bets. Now, they won't tell you it's a bet because they don't really think in the sort of binary outcomes. So for me, I was like, okay, what's the starting point? For a diversified mutual fund, the 1940 Act says you can't have more than 25% of your portfolio in positions that are 5% or more. So by the SEC's definition, 5% is sort of the starting point. So I used that as the base and said, okay, we're going to try to find every position that averaged 5% of the portfolio over its lifetime. But I was like, okay, well, we need to do a little more. Like, let's just not use that as the base. Let's go a little higher. So I was, talking to people in the halls and on different ratings committees and all that. And we kind of, we said like 8% is where, on our team, we're like 8% is getting pretty high. So 8% is the minimum we needed to see as the max. So 5% average, at least 8% at some point in time over the holding period. And then finally, again, it needs to be a bet. So it's like, well, you need to be taking an active stance against the market. So it needs to be a 5% active position, meaning it's 5% more than what would be in the index. So you think about the big stocks today, like Apple is like 12% of the Russell 1000 growth. We would want to see 17% position to call it a bet.
All right. But most active fund managers, they don't make these big bets, right? But there's been an increase. What's going on there?
Yeah. So if you go back to like 1997, you had like 3% of portfolio managers had what we call what I define as a big bet in their portfolio. Fast forward to 2023, you had 14% of managers doing it. So more than a 4x increase. Now, what drove that? It was mostly, the gamma stocks or the Magnificent Seven, whatever you really want to call them. They became so big in the Russell 1000 growth and the Russell 1000 that, managers who wanted to express any sort of conviction in it sort of had to get above that 5% average weight. And then you see a lot of them bump over that 8% threshold for the max size. We still wanted to see the active bet. So the active piece was still there, but it's that basket of stocks that drove the increase. If you take those stocks out of the pool, the level of bets is sort of similar to what it was 25 years ago. It dipped coming out of the Great Recession and rose back up, but it's not like, it's not a huge difference once you remove those.
So most big bets paid off. The active managers, they picked their winning stocks. Well, did it help or hurt their portfolios?
There's a few ways to look at it. So if you look over the holding period of the stocks, roughly 60% of the bets paid off. What that means is over the holding period, the stock beat the underlying benchmark. So it was a winner. Over those same periods, though, the funds themselves only 33-ish percent, actually like 37%, but only about a third beat the benchmark. So there's this conundrum of you're betting on these winners, but yet you're still underperforming. So there's a few reasons for that. One is that the bet size. So we had that 8% sort of minimum max, if that makes sense. Very few got above 12%, though. So even at your biggest size, your 12%, you still have 88% of your portfolio in other stocks that's going to drive the majority of the portfolio's performance. So that's a piece of it. And then another piece is the point at which the bet is its biggest size. So we looked at that also where, okay, once it's the biggest percent of the portfolio, how does the stock then do? Because that's the point where the manager is expressing his or her biggest conviction, like this is the winner. And if you start at that point and go and look forward, over half lose value on an absolute basis, and like a vast majority end up underperforming the benchmark. So there's an issue of like it outperformed over the holding period, but in the period where it commanded the most amount of assets, the bets did poorly.
Well, what if they never made those bets? I mean, how would their portfolios fare then?
Turns out it doesn't really matter. So on the side of the funds that underperformed their benchmarks, if you took the bets out of those funds, 98% of them still would have underperformed the benchmark. So the bets were not the reason for the fund underperforming. It was just poor stock picking throughout the portfolio that was the reason. On the other side, if you look at the stocks that did outperform the benchmark, 75% would have outperformed the benchmark even without the bet. So those were funds where the managers were picking good stocks throughout the portfolio and didn't even really need the big bet to get that sort of, you know, index topping performance. So that was one of the key takeaways, is that, you know, you need good stock picking throughout a portfolio. And, you know, you can't really rely on one big bet to swing the outcome one way or another.
And what kind of companies or businesses were they wagering on?
Not surprisingly, we talked about the big sort of Magnificent Seven. That's the majority of the bets. So what I was kind of interested in seeing was, are these professional money managers, are they betting on any sort of unique stories that maybe the average everyday investor doesn't? And not really. So you don't see them betting on like big turnaround stories. So you think about like the GameStop mania from a couple years ago. That's all the retail investors, one trying to like, you know, screw over hedge funds on the short squeeze. But there's also this like turnaround story of like, well, we can like build the business back up and then make these big gains. You don't really see professional managers doing that. You don't see them buying unprofitable companies and placing big wagers on them. You see them buying big established entrenched companies, Alphabet, Apple, Microsoft, those kinds. And those are the majority of the bets.
Now, you've mentioned the Magnificent Seven a couple of times. Can the market concentration in those companies explain any increase in the big bets?
It certainly explains the increasing likelihood of it, just because, again, when a stock is 10% of the index, most managers are going to hold at least 5% in there, just because, you know, they don't want one stock to dictate, you know, their relative performance. So they're all going to hold it. Most of them are at least going to hold it for some sort of risk management purposes. So just from the sheer size alone, they're going to check usually two of the boxes, being the average position size and then the max position size. They hit both that 5% and 8% threshold. Then it's just a question of, was it ever a big active bet? And for a lot of managers, you look back and it has been at times. Like they've, you know, Microsoft hasn't always been 10% of the index. And at times, you know, a manager might have had 8% in it when it was 3% of the benchmark. And then you get that 5%. Because again, we looked at the whole holding period, which for some managers can be, you know, 10, 12 years where they're holding Microsoft. And at some point in time in that holding period, if they had it for 5%, then it counts. So there are some definitional, you know, things going on underneath the hood, but definitely the concentration alone is a lot of the story.
So what surprised you about the best and the worst bets over the last 25 years?
You know, the surprising thing to me was the maximum, the performance after the maximum position size. You know, I did this to just sort of, I guess, sanity check some just basic heuristics we have in manager research and investing overall, which is like, diversification is great. And so I came into this like, well, you know, are there managers who don't need, who don't need a diversified approach, and they can use a more concentrated, bigger position size style? And so it confirmed on one hand that like the diversification piece is important and that these bets alone aren't swinging performance. But then on the individual stock surprises, you've got some fund companies that have huge stakes in sort of random companies. Like you have Horizon Kinetics, which is run by a guy named Murray Stahl, but a bunch of their funds have huge, huge stakes in this company, Texas Pacific Land Corp, which owns a bunch of land in Texas, and they lease, you know, oil and gas rights out to oil companies and all that. But those have done exceedingly well, and it's all been driven by just these positions in just this one company. And so you get these examples, Barron with Tesla is another example, where you do see, you know, just a very one position driving a huge outperformance. And then the question is, well, you know, if when we're recommending funds to investors or to clients, is that something we really, you can count on going forward? And I think that's going back to the position side, the maximum position size, where we get a little skeptical is that, you know, clearly managers have a little struggle with, you know, seeing the peak valuation of a company. And so the question is, with those two, have we reached a peak valuation and you're still sitting on these huge, huge sizes in the portfolio? So, like I said, it's interesting in that it has worked for a handful of them, but, you know, there's always examples of those backfiring too.
Now, what about the stock pickers that pulled it off and they beat their benchmarks? Did they strike gold a second time?
Another interesting finding of the study was, I guess, the success of subsequent bets. So whether or not they hit it big on the first one or lost big on the first one, we found that betting, you know, subsequent bets, your success starts to decline. So not only does your probability of beating the benchmark, meaning your stock actually beating the benchmark, not your fund, that declines consistently with the number of bets you make. And on top of that, the probability, I shouldn't say the probability, but the prevalence of big blowups increases. So we define big blowups as losing 50% or more within the stock price. So what's interesting there is there could be like two different dynamics. One being the manager who hit it big maybe gets overconfident and says, ah, look, I made all this money on this one big bet. I can do it again. And then maybe he does, maybe he doesn't. But then if you don't, there's that's classic, you know, casino dilemma of, well, I just lost $100 at the blackjack table. I'll just go get another 100 and put it on one hand and then see if I can make my money back. There seems to be some sort of, at least some element of throwing good money after bad. I'm like, oh, I missed on the first one, but I'm going to try to get it back on another big bet. So we don't know exactly sort of what the split is between those two, but there is at least some evidence of both of those things going on.
And is there another example of, you know, we're coming off, maybe it's like gambling. Is there another reason why someone may say, I can do it again? Is it ego?
It could be ego. It could be, you know, these people, most portfolio managers get to where they are because they've been successful throughout their career. And it's like a professional athlete. You have to have guts and you have to have a belief in yourself to be good at it, because there are going to be moments where you don't look good. And so you have to be able to have the fortitude to stick through it and say, no, I'm right. And I am talented and I can do this. So I think there is a lot of that. I guess you can call it ego of like, I know what I'm doing. I know this hasn't paid off before, but I'm sure I can get it right this next time.
All right, so let's wrap this up with some key takeaways for investors.
I think the key takeaway, I mean, gambling is it's attractive, right? Because it's a shortcut. You don't why work for 20 years when I can go buy a lottery ticket and get the money now and I don't have to work for it, right? And I think there is a strain of that when it comes to investing, where if you talk to anybody on the street, a lot of them think there's this shortcut that you can take. Oh, the insiders know. There's this cabal of insiders in finance who know all the secret stock tips. And if I only could get one of those tips, I'll be able to bet it all on there and get my financial freedom. But I think this shows that like good, even among professional money managers, good investing is often done through a very sort of boring, just consistent approach where it's little successes here and there build up, but you can't count on trying to make one big bet to drive an outcome. It's just not something that is easily repeatable or even leads to any sort of long-term success.
All right. So take the boring path.
Yeah, it's boring, but it's successful.
Well, thank you, Jack, for your time today.
Thank you.
That wraps up this week's episode. Thanks for listening. If you enjoy hearing market trends and analyst insights on our podcast, feel free to leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help others find us. Thanks to craft editor and cinematographer David Ettinger and senior video producer Jake Vankerson. I'm Ivana Hampton, a senior multimedia editor at Morningstar. Take care.
This recording is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. Opinions expressed are as of the date of recording. Such opinions are subject to change. The views and opinions of guests on this program are not necessarily those of Morningstar Inc. and its affiliates. While this guest may license or offer products and services of Morningstar and its affiliates, unless otherwise stated, he or she is not affiliated with Morningstar and its affiliates. Morningstar does not guarantee the accuracy or the completeness of the data presented herein. Morningstar Research Services is a subsidiary of Morningstar Inc. and is registered with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Morningstar Research Services shall not be responsible for any trading decisions, damages, or other losses resulting from or related to the information, data analyses, or opinions, or their use. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. All investments are subject to investment risk, including possible loss of principal. Individuals should seriously consider if an investment is suitable for them by referencing their own financial position, investment objectives, and risk profile before making any investment decision.